The sun is a vital source of light and warmth, but it also produces violent flares and eruptions that can disrupt navigation, communication, and electricity here on Earth. These disruptive events occur when magnetic field energy stored through the sun's million-degree corona is readily converted into other forms by a process that is still poorly understood. The physics behind this energy conversion remains the focus of active research, both through theoretical modeling and observation using orbiting X-ray telescopes. In this first Provost Distinguished Lecture of the fall 2022 semester, Dana Longcope, professor and head of the Department of Physics at Montana State University Bozeman, discusses his work and the current state of knowledge in this lecture titled, Solar Flares, Dramatic, Disruptive, and Puzzling. It was recorded at the Museum of the Rockies on October 18, 2022. Dana Longcope is introduced by Dr. Richard Canfield, research professor retired in the MSU Department of Physics.
In 1993, at a meeting of the American Astronomical Society, in which, because he had joined subsequent to his PhD at Cornell in 91, a former student of mine from UCSD. With this student, he held, with guidance from this student, he held what's called a Miller Fellowship, which was a fellowship part of a program to identify people who were, the goal was to identify people who were going to succeed in the research business. And I must say, in Dana's case, they've succeeded in spades. Now, earlier this year, Dana was elected to the National Academy of Sciences. Most of you may know it, but I better just run through that. National Academy of Sciences was established in 1863 in legislation that was signed by Abraham Lincoln. It has about 3,000 members at the present time, 190 of which are Nobel Prize winners. Their mission in life, their role, is to give advice to citizens, to people, give advice to our nation in all respects regarding science. So why is Dana so well-suited for this role? Well, to that you need basically to turn to his vita, and I'm not going to take the time to do that. I'm just going to hit a few highlights to illustrate the following point. Dana is well qualified for this role as an elected member of the National Academy of Sciences. He came to MSU in 1996 as an assistant professor. He had done his Miller Fellowship with George Fisher, a former student of mine. And so I was fortunate to get off to a good start in collaboration with Dana at that time. When you look at his vita, you look at university service and teaching and professional service and research in solar physics, it's impressive, no doubt about it. The university service, for example, in his vita you'll see 22 items called out. And as you know, if you've done it, there is a good bit of committee work involved in that, and he's probably got a cast iron butt to help him get through that. But it turns out that that has served him well later in his career. First, though, he's risen to the role of the department head in physics, and some of these ways, sitting on his backside, or involved searches of various sorts for the College of Letters and Science, planning activities, all those sorts of things. In teaching, he's been very active. I can identify 10 graduate students that he's mentored, and he's mentored far more undergraduates than that. His interest in undergraduates is impressive. His participation in the Physics Learning Center, one-on-one tutoring with undergraduates, is really to be admired. And then there's the other application for that cast iron butt I was talking about, and that is professional service. If you do as much work as Dana has done for the National Research Council, for NASA, National Solar Observatory, the American Astronomical Society, American Geophysical Union, the Institute for Theoretical Physics, you've utilized that butt on many an airplane for many an occasion. You're well drained. The other thing that I should mention is he's participated in search committees for more institute directors and organizational heads than you can shake a stick at. His research in solar physics is what we most have in common. He's interested in magnetic fields and convection. He's applied his knowledge of magnetic fields to solar flares and to solar eruptions that affect the Earth. ADS, the Astrophysical Data Center Service, lists 132 publications of which abstracts are identified, and among other things, they tell you how much they've been used. It's a measure of how other people are using them and how. He's got 130 publications in there, and of them, 42 have more than 42 citations. 42 of those 150 papers have been cited more than 40 times. Some of them have been cited hundreds of times, but more have been cited 42 times. That's an amazing contribution to the scientific community and a measure of what he's gotten done during his career. My pleasure to introduce Dana Warfield. Longhope, solar flares, dynamics, eruptive, and puzzling.
Thank you very much, Dick. And thank you all for coming. It's a nice crowd here. I want to start off, I want to say, this is a talk by me, but it's really work done by a really remarkable group of people. Here we are through many years. There's Dick in 2004. This is the MSU Solar Physics Group. It's one of the premier groups of its kind in the world. And a lot of what we know about the sun, about the solar corona, about space weather, people all over the world use, and you can trace those results back to Bozeman, Montana, our group, and when they've gone on from there. So it's been a wonderful opportunity to work with this remarkable group of scientists. And the whole group owes its existence to Lauren Acton. And he is the founder of this group. He graduated from MSU in 1959. Then he left Bozeman, flew around the Earth on the Space Shuttle Challenger. I'd say even more remarkable accomplishment, he built a X-ray telescope that is really one of the first of its kind, really made our field a different field. And then he returned to Bozeman and became a research professor in 1993, and he formed our remarkable group around him, and it has been great. So I would not be here, Dick would not be here, many of us would not be here were it not for Lauren. The scientific leader of our group, right from the beginning, was Dr. Canfield. And here you see him in the midst of a discussion of magnetic helicity, I believe. I'll point out, though, this is taken from the peer-reviewed scientific literature of the 130 papers that Dr. Canfield has published. And I have cited it, as one must, with scientific literature. So there it is. If you want to go to Solar Physics, volume 297, page 94, that's this paper. Yeah, but Dick really was the scientific leader of our group, and so I owe a great deal to him as well. Really sort of formulated my ideas in these kinds of discussions with him. And then, of course, there's so many collaborators, starting with my thesis advisor, Ravi Sudan. There's George Fisher, Dick's former student. Eric Priest goes all the way down. Another former research scientist, Alex Peftsoff, a couple of professors from MSU. And then, of course, so many wonderful PhD students that have gone on to do great things, all MSU students. So this is really their story more than mine. It's been wonderful working with all of them. But I'm going to start in on the sun, and I'm going to start with this image here. How many people got to see the solar eclipse in 2017? How many people, keep your hands up if you got to be on the path of totality? All right, excellent. That was just such a remarkable event. And when you stand there in that eerily lit landscape, the light that is lighting that landscape is sunlight reflecting off of electrons out here in the extended solar atmosphere, 1,000,000 degree, 2,000,000 degree electrons. And they are scattering the light right down to you. And then that's what gives the corona its name. It comes from the term for crown. Sort of looks like a crown. Now, I've been studying the corona more or less my whole career, and these eclipses don't occur very often. So we have another way of studying the corona. If you look at the sun, and you shouldn't look at the sun, from the ground you see a bright ball and maybe some spots. But we have a way of looking at shorter wavelengths, and the only thing that you see in those shorter wavelengths is material that's, in this case, very specifically 1.5 million degrees. And the solar disk, this nice round ball, is pitch black in that wavelength because nothing in that. This is a mere 6,000 degrees, right? This is freezing cold. This is 1.5 million. This is nice, toasty, warm corona. And that's the way we work. I need to do a little bit of physics here. The way this works is you may have had some basic physics. There's a wide range, a spectrum of wavelengths. This is what we think of as a spectrum. Roy G. Biv, reading from right to left, red, etc. And so when you look from the ground, that's what you see. The solar disk is 5,800 Kelvin, 5,800 Celsius, doesn't matter. Virtually no difference when you're dealing with thousands or millions of degrees. And that's the range of wavelengths we see. Just short of that, if you go short of violet, short of the V in Roy G. Biv, you get ultraviolet. And you do get a little of that on the ground. But after that, you get to far ultraviolet. And that will show you the sun in, this is 100,000 degrees. Okay? It looks quite different. You can see where the sunspots are. It's kind of brightish there. So instead of being dark, it's bright. When you go to one of my favorite wavelengths, 193 angstroms, this is the far ultraviolet. 193 angstroms is the extreme ultraviolet. Okay, this is the way we work. Ultraviolet, far ultraviolet, extreme ultraviolet. Now you're seeing million degree stuff. X-rays. This is 4 million degree stuff, and then hard X-rays. Really, you see nothing except for a few minutes every day. You'll see a flare. So from all of these very short wavelengths, getting progressively shorter, you see different parts of the sun. And this is what we use to study the sun, this part of the sun, the corona, except that's the names for those places. The Earth's atmosphere absorbs all of this, okay? You're probably familiar with the ozone layer absorbing a little bit of this ultraviolet. This is absorbed by everything. The whole atmosphere absorbs all of these short wavelengths, and it's a good thing because they're not very pleasant. They don't give you sunburn. They'll basically give you bad diseases. So it's good that it's blocking this radiation from us, but it also means we can't study it unless we go into space. So that's what we do. We do all of our observations in these wavelengths from spacecraft. The instrument that I showed you that Dr. Acton built was one of the first of its kind working on X-ray telescope in space. This is one of the more recent ones, and I'm going to show you a lot of cool imagery from this. The Solar Dynamics Observatory was launched in 2010, and it is in geosynchronous orbit for a number of reasons I've shown here. It sees the sun more or less continuously every day of every minute of every day. It makes images in 8 of these extreme ultraviolet wavelengths every 12 seconds. Okay, so that's 1.4 terabytes of imagery a day. These are 4096 by 4096. They are available. If you want them, they're for you. You can download the images. You can actually download the real data if you want to work on it. If you're not inclined to that kind of high-tech stuff, it's also available at the post office. They have postage stamps with those images. And you can impress the postal workers by pointing out that, yeah, that's 193 angstroms. That's about 1.5 million Kelvin. So this spacecraft is what we'd use for a lot of our science. And one of the other things I want to alert you to is when we're seeing this extreme ultraviolet hot plasma, we're actually seeing lines of magnetic force, magnetic field lines. just like from a horseshoe magnet, you have all these magnetic field lines that go from the North Pole to the South Pole, but you can't see them, right? Your physics teacher tells you they're there. But if you have a 1.5 million degree plasma, and I wouldn't advise that you actually try to build one of those in the classroom, but if you have one, it will trace out these lines of force. And so we have a North Pole and a South Pole there, and you can see all the little field lines are coming out there, and also nice little loops. We'll see more there. And that's actually where the sunspots are, too. We won't talk too much about sunspots, but you've probably heard about them. On the solar disk, there are little blemishes, and that's basically where the magnetic field originates. But in the 1.5 million degree images, these 193 angstrom images, we see beautiful versions of it. And I'm going to make sure you see a really beautiful version. Every 12 seconds, it's making these images, and it goes on for years and years and years. It's just stunning. You can see there's a number of poles, one after another, lined up, and the field lines being traced out by these. And this is just the corona on a typical day, right? Nothing really remarkable happening, but you see all sorts of little brightenings and things. Those are interesting to study in their own right. And you see other parts of the sun without so much magnetic field, but still fascinating to watch. So it's beautiful, but I wouldn't say dramatic. So now we're going to get to the dramatic stuff. Very similar image. Keep your eye right around there. This is right about to go around the other side of the sun. And we see a little flash, and then another one, and then material blows out into space. This is a flare, and I will talk a lot more about what flares are. So the sun will stay like we saw it before for days, and then boom, that kind of thing happens. And that is a solar flare. See another one over here. You'll see it actually kind of spreads out and disturbs things all around it. This is the kind of thing that goes on with a solar flare. And I will talk in a bit about what is actually happening. This one's remarkable. This is a different wavelength. Keep your eye right up there. That one goes up. And actually, it does not manage to eject that material off the sun. It comes right back down again. We can watch that one again. That sounds like a crowd favorite. Yeah. As I said, 1.4 terabytes a day of this stuff, and it's all there on the web. Some of the files can be a little big. Don't download a whole day's worth. So that's a solar flare and a failed coronal mass ejection. What is a solar flare? Well, just a typical large-ish solar flare like the kinds I've been showing you. The brightness of the sun is going to increase by, it increases by a factor of 100 in X-rays. So here is a plot, the weather satellite that shows you all these nice infrared videos of storms and clouds, also monitors the sun in X-rays. This is a trace. It's a logarithmic plot, so not everyone is cool with that. But it shows the sun getting brighter. There's its sort of resting position, resting brightness in X-rays. And in the course of a few minutes, it goes up a factor of 100 in brightness. That is a solar flare. Remarkably, if you looked at its overall brightness in white light, it's 1% of a percent, 0.01% or less. It's almost, except for the really big solar flares, it's very difficult to even detect the overall change. So X-rays are really the way to study solar flares. X-rays are extreme ultraviolet. For these images here, it's a blow-up of a flare going on there. This gives you an idea. It extends off from the surface of the sun. That's the size of the Earth. So that's the kind of thing we're looking at. The sun is big. This shouldn't surprise anyone. The amount of energy it releases, if you know the physics notation, 10 to the 31 ergs, or 500 million times the energy in a magnitude 7 earthquake. Okay, so this would not be good. It's 10 times the energy delivered by that asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs. So all the bones in the rest of this museum, all due to something that was only a tenth as energetic as this. And this, as I said, is a biggish one. There's a lot that are only as big as the dinosaur-killing asteroid. And it does heat the plasma up to 30 million degrees or so. So what you're seeing here is a different wavelength of the light that we're getting, that kind of 30 million Kelvin, 30 million degrees C. There's a second part to this. Those are the flares. There's something that often accompanies a big flare, And I won't, we've argued for a long time about which causes which. We're not going to get to the bottom of that tonight, but they usually go together. You get one, you get the other. It's about 1 billion tons of gas is ejected. And it's really the same gas the sun is made of. Nothing surprising. It's hydrogen and helium. The amount of mass here is only 0.1% of that asteroid. So it's not all that much stuff. I mean, yeah, I couldn't lift 1 billion tons, but on the grand scheme of things, it's a bit of material. It's huge. It's bigger than the Earth. And it is going at 2 million miles per hour. That's a typical speed for this. So the kinetic energy is about as big as the kinetic energy of the flare itself, right? That's just the stuff that gets launched into space. It goes off into the solar system, and yes, it can hit the Earth. The Earth is really small compared to how big this gets, so not much of it hits the Earth. We'll get into the things that go on there. But in the title, I mentioned that there's a puzzle here, and I want to sort of get to the idea of what it is I do all day. Making movies is really cool, but I do science with this. And the idea of a solar flare was tracked down to something called magnetic reconnection. And it was proposed for solar flares by Gene Parker, my predecessor at the National Academy, and another guy named Peter Sweet. Basically, when Lauren Acton was a sophomore or a junior, is how long ago this was proposed. Shortly after that, a guy named Dungy proposed that, oh, this magnetic reconnection stuff probably also happens in the Earth's magnetic field, and that's what causes northern lights, among other things. So the two of these ideas were about the same time, and they said, oh, there's this magnetic reconnection thing, and it's probably what causes a solar flare and what leads to these geomagnetic storms. Later, when people started trying to build nuclear fusion reactors in the lab, they realized, oh, yeah, and the same thing is happening there. One thing you can see from all these plots is I'm tracing out field lines, and they all cross at some point. Even in the fusion reactor, they all cross there, there, there. That's really the key to magnetic reconnection. It's the crossing of those magnetic field lines. And what is it? Well, the first thing is this very hot plasma is an electrical conductor. And if you've maybe taken a little bit of physics, you remember that in an electrical conductor, the electric field should be zero. And it is. In a plasma, it is very much zero until it's not. So when it is zero, and if I take, this is supposed to be the magnetic field, it's a cartoon from 4 sunspots, 1, 2, 3, 4, and these middle inner two are going to start moving together, but the magnetic field can't actually break, the field lines can't break. And it's a bit complicated, but they can't break because the electric field is zero. And so if they can't break, what happens is they get smooshed together as these two inner sunspots move together and form, this is electrical current. And we get about 1 trillion amps of current in one of these things going along the through the solar corona. And that's all because the electric field is zero. And then suddenly it's not zero. This is the big mystery. This is the puzzle. What causes this plasma that's really supposed to be a very good conductor to suddenly forget that fact? And when it does forget the fact that all of that current is then dissipated, released, and all those field lines then go back to a state that isn't storing energy, and it releases that energy. This is the thing that was first proposed in 1958, that this must be what's happening to cause a solar flare. And those of us who've worked on it for 60 years, this is our sort of language. I'm just showing these to show off. This is the equations of magnetohydrodynamics, which I love. It's one single word, and it gets a three-letter abbreviation, MHD. So we sit there and talk about MHD all the time. And these are the equations, and they describe how this hot plasma and this magnetic field should behave. One of the things that may surprise you if you don't know physicists is we're able to write down equations pretty readily that we can't solve, right? And not just that we don't know what this means. We know what it means, but we don't know a solution to it. And so we write computer codes, try to, you know, I spend most of my time writing and debugging computer codes to solve these equations and try to learn something about magnetic reconnection, about solar flares from them. And we've learned a lot, not me in particular, but my colleagues, all of us who've been doing this for over 60 years. We've learned this bit about the energy buildup, that when the electric field is zero, the magnetic field lines don't break and energy is stored up. It concentrates in currents, in electrical currents, that form into these long sheets. And if the electric field actually becomes non-zero, that energy will be released. And we do know that that electric field can be non-zero only in a very small region. And small, I'm talking about, you know, hundreds of kilometers across. But on the sun, that's very small. Those things we've pretty much figured out. So we have been doing something. What we don't know, what we still puzzle over after 60 years of sitting there thinking about this, what is it that causes the electric field to suddenly appear? And it appears suddenly. You saw magnetic field could sort of go about its merry business for days and days, and then bam, in 10 minutes, it's released all this energy. How does the electric field get large enough to release the energy in 2 minutes or 10 minutes? It really gets very big for that kind of thing. And how is it that this magnetic energy suddenly becomes heat? Sunspots are dark because they're actually cooler. Magnetic field can make things cooler. Apparently, it can also make things hotter. Sometimes it even gets up to 50 million Kelvin. And then, in addition to heating stuff up, it actually creates relativistic electrons. This is different than heating. It's called particle acceleration. So these are some of the puzzles that I was at a conference last week, and we were still puzzling over this. What will do all these things? Just to give you some idea that we're making progress, and this is actually from MSU. Here's an observation of another flare. This is the one we were looking at last week. And this is a model from Dr. Chunming Zhu, working at MSU, and a student, Brock Parker. And this is their solutions to the MHD equations, approximate solutions. And it's not perfect, but it's pretty darn good, in my opinion. We're getting there. We're finding ways of actually answering these questions, or at least showing that we know how to produce something that looks similar. Okay, so we're going to keep working on this. But now I think I have to come to the part that is the disruptive part, not of the talk, but of solar flares. This is the same flare. However, there's the whole sun in 193 angstroms. That's where the flare is going to be. And we'll watch that. And boom, it just went. And what you see here are two other instruments that work like they basically make an artificial eclipse. You can see there's a little arm here. It's holding a disk. It's blocking out the sun. And what's you're seeing is reflected sunlight, just like in the solar eclipse. But you don't usually get to see this in a solar eclipse. You actually see the material, this 0.1% of an asteroid worth of material being blown off of the sun. And it's heading off into space. And that's a coronal mass ejection. The flare and the coronal mass ejection, as I said, they go together. In this case, you really can see that the flare cannot really be the cause here. If you look carefully, you'll see there's a coronal mass ejection in the back, then a flare, then another coronal mass ejection. So it's a confusing pattern there. This is a model that actually is used by the space weather forecasters. This is looking down on the whole solar system. So there's the sun. This nice sprinkler spiral shape is all of the stuff that just usually comes off of the sun. And then you see this big blast that is the coronal mass ejection. These dots are our planets. There's Earth, Venus, Mars. And then the squares, these are not to scale. These are some of the spacecraft that NASA has orbiting around the sun. And you can see this eruption heads off. And Earth takes a sort of glancing blow from it. Okay, so the Earth is being hit by this material. Now, if this whole thing is the mass of a tenth of mass of the asteroid, you can see the Earth gets a very small piece of it. But it does do something. This is a much nicer picture of the Earth, but these magnetic field lines are from a real model, solution of the MHD equations. And this shows you what happens to our magnetic field when one of these big coronal mass ejections hits it. Boom. And you'll actually be able to see the little magnetic field lines getting stretched and then snapping back. Magnetic reconnection. This is what's going on there and also there. So this is the kind of thing that will happen when a coronal mass ejection occurs and actually does hit the Earth. It doesn't hit the Earth itself. It hits the Earth's magnetic field. But that does have effects. This is just an animation of a model that someone made. It's a very sophisticated model solving the MHD equations on the computer. And so you can see the colors are representing the, I believe, the density of the plasma in places. So we don't get hit by the material, but our magnetic field gets yanked around. And that's enough to do things. This is a slide I stole from Bill Murtaugh. He used to be at the Office of Science and Technology Policy at the White House. And this was from a flare. I'll show you a bit more of it. In October of 2003, we like to name all of our flares, or the coronal mass ejection of that same time, after holidays. We call this the Halloween flare. Very appropriate. And after this CME hit the Earth, we had various aircraft flights, commercial flights, which were scheduled to go over the pole, had to be rerouted because all of that energy is coming down through the North Pole of the Earth's magnetic field. And there were power outages, mostly in Europe at this time. GPS kind of flaked out. You can see that affected drilling rigs. It affected oil rigs and drilling rigs. If you happen to be in Antarctica at the time, and this, of course, is right at the end of, this is in the spring in Antarctica, they lost radio communication for 130 hours. So it was probably a little troubling to them. This is the result of the flare. This is just a map of the Earth and something that shows where high-frequency communications was disrupted, mostly over Africa because that was in daylight at the time it hit. Oh, and one of Japan's satellites was lost as a result of this. So there's a lot of consequences. It has been true for a while. The mother of all flares was an event in 1859, September 1st, known as the Carrington event. Carrington was a professional beer maker. He owned a brewery, and his hobby was observing the sun. And he had a telescope set up in his shed, and he was tracing out the sunspots, and he saw, you can barely make it out, but there are two little white areas. He saw these white flashes on the sunspot and actually ran out to get his manservant. He was a beer maker, a wealthy person. When he came back, there was nothing there to see. 18 hours later, there was a lot to see, but not necessarily in England. Here is the Northern Lights. We're going to be seeing some great ones coming up. This is the Northern Lights. How many people have seen the Northern Lights in New Orleans, Louisiana? Probably not. The last time it was visible was in 1859. This is a picture of the Northern Lights they saw in New Orleans when this event happened. You can see they also saw Northern Lights in Colombia. I don't think it's on here. They saw it in Hawaii. They saw it in Havana. This disturbed the Earth's magnetic field tremendously when it slammed into the Earth. It also disrupted, we have GPS, we have cell phones, we have electricity. Back then, they had one mode of communication that was high-tech, and it was the telegraphs. And this really showed up on the telegraph lines. One thing they did was they disconnected the batteries, and they could send signals across the country just using the voltage that was created by the disturbance in the Earth's magnetic field. But you should be careful. There was a fire at one of the telegraph stations, probably due to this. We're not sure about that. Anyway, it was quite an event. We have not seen its like since, but it's, you know, just like big earthquakes, you know it's coming eventually. And here's what it did to transformers. This is the October event, not the Carrington event. This is the October's Halloween event. Fried some transformers in South Africa. I remember this event. This was in March of 1989, and it fried transformers in Quebec, blacked out some of upstate New York, fortunately not Ithaca. We saw some great northern lights with that. So, yeah, it can disrupt the power systems, especially in northern states. Okay? But we all had a power outage 2 days ago. It was not space weather. We also have to worry about... This is unconfirmed reports, but I heard it was a squirrel. Yeah, so yes, space weather is potentially disruptive, but there's other disruptions you could worry about. Just show you, we are doing something. This is the National Weather Service does have a forecasting center, the Space Weather Prediction Center in Boulder, Colorado. Nice website. You can go there. Just swipsynoaa.gov. And they give you up-to-the-minute forecasts of what space weather to predict, what to expect. They show us some of these cool images, the coronagraph with the CMEs coming out, an image of where the aurora might be. I also have one of these on my phone. And because it's the weather service, they can tell you, yes, there's aurora overhead, but it's cloudy out and you're not going to see them. So they can do both. Hopefully in the next year or so, we'll have some good aurora when it's not cloudy in Bozeman. I'm tired of seeing these pictures sent in by people in Idaho or Billings that saw beautiful northern lights and it was cloudy here. The way this all works is the sun's magnetic field. This is all magnetic field and magnetic reconnection, and the sun generates its own magnetic field. It's an AC generator. So it oscillates with a period of about 11 years, but you can see this sine wave is not a great sine wave. Okay, if you had a signal generator like this, you would not be happy. But it's about 11 years. We've began numbering them, because what else? We're scientists, we number things. It just starts at some arbitrary point back in time. These are the times of the 1859, the Carrington event. There's the Halloween flare. There's the big event that happened in Quebec, or blacked out Quebec. And you can see it happens at the maxes. So we are trying to figure out where the solar cycle is going. Here it was in 2000, cycle 23. This was our disappointing cycle 24. Not great aurora 10 years ago. Cycle 25 is shaping up to be a little better. So I think we're going to see better aurora. It's heading up. This is still our uncertainty. We don't know where it's heading, but we think it's going to peak in about 2 years. And so that we're going to be seeing space weather events up until then and even after that. So that's everything I had to tell you. I'd be thrilled to answer any questions you have. What really happens? That's a good question. Oddly enough, the solar cells are kind of generating their power locally. What really gets hit is long wires that are delivering electricity across great distances. And when you take physics in school, you'll learn that if you take a wire and move it through a magnetic field, or you take the wire and make the magnetic field change across it, it generates a current. That's what gets you. A little small house-sized solar cell, that's not going to happen. So you'll be fine.
My question is, are protections being built into utilities?
Good question, yeah. I can't speak to protections against squirrels. Apparently those are not working. But Bill Murtaugh, this is based on briefings he was giving. And Congress has passed a law that is sort of making sure that we're taking this seriously and getting ready for big events like this. Protections are mostly the power companies can operate in a way that makes them less prone to these kinds of things. Protections for spacecraft, for satellites, is to power them down. They work with high voltages, and when particles come through, they can short things out. There was one event, though. Elon Musk was launching 49 of his satellites, and he was in such low Earth orbit. When one of these events hit the upper Earth's atmosphere, it inflated the upper Earth's atmosphere, and 40 of those satellites, I think $40 million, came crashing down. But Elon has a lot of money, so I'm not that worried about it. But yeah, to answer your question, yes, we have ways of mitigating. The people that are affected by this have ways of mitigating it. That's why the Space Weather Prediction Center is in business. It wants to tell them, take your measures now.
Does your study of fusion reactions in the sun help inform creation of fusion reactors on Earth?
Ah, good question. Honestly, the study of fusion reactions in the sun went on in the 60s, and they pretty much nailed it. And it is the same constituents are undergoing the reactions, but you can't really get to the densities that you get at the center of the sun. So the trick to magnetic fusion reactions, as we envision it, is to use these magnetic fields to confine a much lower density plasma and then allow the reactions, and actually much hotter. The fusion reactors operate at about 100 million Kelvin, and the center of the sun only has to be at 15 million. So if you have density on your side and gravity helping, then you don't need that.
You said when you have CME, the magnetic field becomes non-zero, and it can be for a small region.
Small region, yeah. Well, that's... I was hoping you'd know. No, we're trying to figure that out. If you haven't heard a lot of scientists, when they say we don't know, I have 40 colleagues, each of whom knows the answer. and all 40 have different answers, and no one can convince the other 39 that their answer is correct. So I could list a bunch of these things. We think it's turbulence created in the plasma. We think it's the anisotropy of the particle distributions. There's a number of things that would do this. We just don't know which one is right. But I'll let you know when we do solve this problem.
So why are sunspots and the polar lights of polar rays of the flare, why are they in the same location?
Oh, good question. The sunspots are the concentrated magnetic field that comes about from the generation of the magnetic field. So the inside the sun is generating the magnetic field, and it pops through the surface in these dense little sunspots. And then the plasma above is heated by that same magnetic field. So that's why you see them in this. You reminded me, I should have mentioned that. That's why you see them in the same place. Yeah, that's a good question. It's cooler because the heat coming out of the sun from the nuclear fusion inside, the magnetic field interferes with that heat coming out. And then somehow in the corona, it turns around and instead of inhibiting heat, it generates its own heat. The surface of the sun, where that all that heat comes out, is only 6,000 Kelvin, 6,000 degrees. It's very cold. And somehow this hot plasma is heated by the magnetic fields. Yeah, it's very puzzling all the way around. Yeah, a future PhD student. It has many, right. However, if you average them all together, and scientists love averaging things, it does end up being a North Pole and a South Pole. And then every other one of these, every even number has a North Pole and a South Pole. Every odd number has it flipped over. So some people will tell you this is an 11-year cycle. You correct them and say it's a 22-year cycle because you have to go from positive to negative, negative to positive, and then back again. It's just the way AC generators work. They go up, down, up, down, up, down. As I said, I think the power companies can operate them in a way that they're not susceptible to this if they know it ahead of time.
You have just heard MSU professor and head of the physics department, Dana Longcope, deliver the first Provost Distinguished Lecture of the fall 2022 semester titled Solar Flares, Dramatic, Disruptive, and Puzzling. It was recorded at the Museum of the Rockies on October 18, 2022. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production, recorded and produced by Joy LaClaire for broadcast and archiving on KGVM Bozeman, Gallatin Valley Community Radio.